are listening to listener-sponsored Community Radio 89.9 FM Madison. Call letters, of course, are WORT. Stay tuned for BBC headlines, and then after that, Madison Bookbeat. Recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never be recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and supported. BBC News with Sue Montgomery. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has joined leaders of Caribbean nations in Jamaica for emergency talks on the crisis in Haiti, where gang leaders are demanding the resignation of the Prime Minister. The State Department said they discuss a proposal developed by the regional bloc, CARICOM, and Haitian stakeholders to speed up a political transition. Will Grant has the latest.
It is expected that the nations of the Caribbean community will call for Prime Minister Henry to resign and set out steps towards a transitional administration. The Biden administration, which initially backed Mr. Henry, is likely to agree with such a plan given the severity of the crisis. However, even if the Prime Minister does step down, Haiti faces huge challenges. The UN Security Council is hoping a Kenyan-led international security force can help to rein in the heavily armed gangs.
The UN Secretary General has called for a ceasefire in Gaza to mark Ramadan, the Muslim month of fasting. Antonio Guterres also called for the release of hostages held by Hamas and the speedy delivery of aid to the Palestinian territory. President Zelensky has hailed Ukraine's first ever Oscar, won by the documentary 20 Days in Mariupol, which details the brutal Russian siege of the port city. He said it showed the truth about what he termed Russian terrorism. James Waterhouse reports.
It's a recognition which is being celebrated across Ukrainian social media, with one news channel calling it a historic victory. In his acceptance speech, the director Mstislav Chernov said it was a film he wished he'd never made and that he'd swap it for Russia stopping its attack on his country. His team of three journalists documented the gradual encirclement of Mariupol by Russian forces. President Zelensky says the horrors of the city must never be forgotten and described the Oscar as a reminder why international help is so critical to his country.
The UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Russia has expressed concern that other prisoners there could suffer the same fate as Alexei Navalny. Mariana Katsarova said the opposition leader's death in a Russian prison was Moscow's responsibility. Imogen Folks reports.
Alexei Navalny was the most famous political detainee in Russia, but by far not the only one. Today, Mariana Katsarova said she was very worried about who could be next. Ms. Katsarova, who is tasked by the UN with scrutinising Russia's human rights record, has already warned that Moscow is revising every conceivable law to make it a tool of oppression and then imprisoning those it regards as opponents. Once in prison, she fears they will suffer the same fate as Alexei Navalny.
BBC News. Passengers on a LATAM flight between Australia and New Zealand say they were told by the pilot that his instrument panel went momentarily blank when the plane suddenly lost altitude. Witnesses describe people being thrown across the cabin, leaving blood on the ceiling. One of the passengers, Brian Jokert, was awakened from his sleep by the incident.
All of a sudden, the plane just, drops. And it wasn't a turbulence-type feeling drop. It was just like, boom, down. And then it felt like it was going over the top of a roller coaster as you hit the apex and was heading downwards. And it woke me up instantly, and I looked up towards the ceiling. My head was back, and my person sitting next to me was glued to the ceiling.
France says several of its government servers have come under a cyber attack of unprecedented intensity. Officials said countermeasures had been taken and access to state websites had been restored. A hacker group calling itself Anonymous Sudan says it's carried out the attack. It's not possible to confirm this.
Donald Trump has asked the judge overseeing his impending criminal trial in New York to delay it until the U.S. Supreme Court rules on the scope of presidential immunity. The case against Mr. Trump is due to begin on the 25th of March. He's charged with falsifying business records in connection to hush money paid to a former porn actress. He has pleaded not guilty. French experts have fired X-rays at an 18th century violin, hoping to discover the secret of its magical sound. The instrument, which is worth millions, was made in 1743. The European Synchrotron Radiation Facility scanned it both to conserve it and to understand why it plays so beautifully. BBC News.
WORT would like to thank the following local restaurants and businesses who provided meals for our hardworking volunteers during our recent winter pledge drive. Bandung, Bonzo, Cardinal Bar, Cooper's Tavern, Einstein's Coffee and Bagels, Glassnickel Pizza West, Hong Kong Cafe, Ian's Pizza on State Street and Francis Street, Just Veggies, Lao Lang Zong, Migrants Madison, Melio's on MLK, Original Pancake House on University Ave, Pizza Bruta, Soups I Did It Again in Spring Green, Teddy Wedgers, Weary Traveler Free House, Wilma's Fund LGBT Assistance, and the Willie Street Co-op. WORT would like to extend our gratitude to these restaurants for helping to put the community in WORT Community Radio through their donations of food. Gratefully yours for nearly 5 decades, this is WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Good afternoon and welcome to Madison BookBeat, WORT's program featuring Wisconsin authors and books. I'm your host, David Ahrens. Today I'm pleased to welcome Cynthia Simmons. Cynthia is the author of Wrong Kind of Paper, a part thriller, part comic tale of coming of age, and The Long Way, a deep excavation into the rotting condition of much of current journalism, or at least what it pretends to be. I'm guessing that it also has some autobiographical elements as well that we'll talk about. For those very long-term listeners with good memories, Cynthia was the news director of WORT about 20 years ago, so her name or perhaps her voice may be familiar. After her stint at this station, Cynthia worked at many daily newspapers, UPI, the AP, and public radio stations. Then she took a turn to the dark side, enrolling at the other UW, that is, the University of Washington, where she earned a law degree. Cindy is now on the faculty of the Belisario College of Communications at Penn State. Well, welcome back to WORT, Cynthia.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So you recently visited the station, is that right?
I did. You all were having your pledge drive, but I met Shelley and saw some longtime volunteers who were there when I was there.
Wow.
SD Denor and Chris Powers. It was really nice to be back.
Chris has always been here. The building was constructed around him.
Around him, yes.
Yeah, I think that's what happened 50 years ago or so. And so what brought you to Madison?
Jan Levine Thal, friend of mine from WORT, she and I are in an online playwright group, and she had her show Overprint produced at the Bartell Theater, so I was there for opening night.
Oh, cool.
It was a great show.
Mm-hmm.
Great show.
Are you a playwright, too?
I am now, yeah. I had written a play when I worked for KUNM, the public station in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I covered the legislature for them in Santa Fe, and I shared a studio with Ernie Mills, who was a longtime reporter, and he covered the riot at the penitentiary of New Mexico, and actually Ernie Mills, this reporter who happens to be personal friends with the man who was governor at the time, negotiated the end to that prison riot, which was the second deadliest prison riot in U.S. history. So I wrote a play about that, and then I also wrote a play about Steve Bannon's involvement with Biosphere 2, which Biosphere 2 was essentially an experiment in giant human terrarium out
some,
in the desert.
Some billionaire funded that.
Steve Bannon was brought in to make it make money, and wound up inspiring a lot of lawsuits, which I read all the documents from, and then wrote a play about that.
Wow. Let's talk a bit about the book, okay? Let's start with the elements of the story in Wrong Kind of Paper. What is the story? If you give listeners sort of the mini cliff notes.
Sure. So Hallie Linden is a young reporter. She's working as a freelancer, but it's the late 80s, and there are just no jobs in journalism. And so she has to take a job in a small town that she's never heard of. And she gets there and she's kind of a snob. She thinks the people are hicks, and everybody tells her, oh, nothing ever happens here. You'll be bored. And her idea is that she's going to find a big story, report it very well, get an award or some recognition, and that'll be her ticket to a bigger newspaper. And what she finds, and I'm not giving away too much, she finds there's police corruption, and it's harder than she thought to nail it down, and she has to depend on people whose basically their lives are put in jeopardy for helping her. Mm-hmm. And so then the question becomes, who does a journalist serve, and what are your obligations to protect your sources?
Mm-hmm. Right. We'll get into some of the other relationships that develop along the way. I mean, one of the things that I liked about it, I mean, she's a actual person. I mean, in terms of that she has a relationship with, a romantic relationship with someone. She has friendships, and those friendships grow and wither and just on and on. So it struck me that there may be some similarities with you, with Hallie. I noticed that she went to McAllister College, the character Hallie.
As did I.
As did you. She majored in cultural anthropology.
She majored in cultural anthropology. She engaged in hookup sex, which I would never do.
I don't think that part's in the book, but go ahead.
she basically was like a lot of McAllister students. So the late 80s were a really hard time for people who were new on the job market because none of the baby boomers would retire. Mm-hmm. And so there was just nobody moving up, and entry-level jobs were not opening up. And so, she's frustrated, as was I, as was pretty much everybody that I graduated with. And we had to take jobs that were just not what we thought we were training for. I talked to a lot of people. I remember my first college reunion. Everybody was working, at group homes or as survey researchers. These were not the jobs that you paid, lots and lots of money to an expensive private liberal arts school to be qualified for.
Did you work at a Daily Observer or one like that?
I worked in many small newspapers. Sadly, the cost cutting and some of the negative aspects of working for a chain newspaper, those repeat all over the country. And when I talk to book clubs, they ask me, were you writing about our town? So the things that are presented that seem kind of familiar, that are kind of icky and bad about the state of journalism at that time, those were common situations.
Sure, sure. I noted that there's quite a bit of discussion, especially at the outset, of your dismay at the fact that the editor and the publisher are the same person. Why is that a problem?
Well, there used to be a wall between advertising and editorial. And there was just never a question in any reputable news organization that advertising did not drive coverage. And the ad people, lots of places, they weren't even allowed in the newsroom. When the editor and the publisher are the same person, the publisher, of course, is concerned with the bottom line and needs that publication to make money. And what we've seen with conglomeration and chain ownership of newspapers is that wall between advertising and editorial has broken down, and reporters are really pressured to write stories that won't just drive sales, but that advertisers want to have their ad next to.
Mm-hmm.
And so that creates a really, really skewed news agenda. And it's bad for democracy when only stories that advertisers want get into the paper.
Right. Frank, who's this editor-publisher, he's pretty blunt about the purpose of the newspaper, and that's to sell ads.
Yeah,
and the purpose of the news story is to get the reader's eyes on the ads. And part of that is to be, not to offend anyone about anything. And the the character, Hallie, is... realizes that's impossible to never to offend, to do a newspaper that actually covers something and may be critical of something or critical of particularly the police or some other schools or some other institution. And it's dull. The paper is incredibly dull. And his view is to, as you write, to rewrite press releases.
Mm-hmm. And there are many places that I worked where that was what was expected.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not journalism. Press releases may be useful in getting information, particularly non-controversial information that you just need to cover, but there has to be a phone call. There has to be digging to see if there's more. And sometimes there is.
Yeah, I mean it's described in the book how the typical front page is a picture of one person handing an oversized check to another person,
mm-hmm.
and that's such a classic and stereotype. I'm surprised that people still do it, but it happens all the time.
Uh-huh.
There's probably not a week that goes by that you don't get that. I was thinking it was about the editor of, and I forget what paper it is. Is it Clinton, Iowa, or it's some Iowa paper that wins awards recently won a Pulitzer or something. And it's either the publisher or the editor, or maybe it's the same person for both. But he described how does the paper stay solvent, and why is this paper still alive given its circulation and so on, and then it's in a fairly poor community, and it's that the people, he makes it part of his task in addition to doing this great journalism, is to print a picture of every child in the community once a year. And every school picture, every school outing, of course, every team pictures and so on. And people will buy the paper for that purpose. And, you know, they sort of get the story along with the picture of their kid. And it's pretty brazen, but I assume the Daily Observer was involved with that kind of stuff, too.
Yeah, well, I want to tell your listeners the name of that that town. It's Art Cullen in Storm Lake, Iowa. And there's an excellent documentary about it that I show to my students called Storm Lake. And that community involvement, that wanting every kid to have their picture in the paper, that's completely reasonable. And that's somewhat in keeping with what WART does. Mm-hmm. It's a community station where everybody can get on the air and talk about the news that matters to them. And a news organization should be involved with their community and should love the children of the community enough to put their pictures in the paper, and should also love their community enough to report on police racism that treats some of those children differently than others.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's that combination of connectedness and vigilance that is what community media should be doing.
But he's able to sort of stay on the bubble of I assume the editor oversees most of this, of having stories which are critical views of aspects of the community, and still to keep the tie with his readers.
Yeah.
Who are only in the community. Nobody from, you know, New York is getting the Storm Lake, whatever.
No.
It's just his community. What was the story that he won the Pulitzer for?
I believe it was for editorial writing. It's been a little while
wondering whether it was some expose of something or other, but that probably wasn't the case. There's quite a bit of instructional material in your book about the practice of journalism, the law, some, you know, just scattered bits about the law concerning journalism, and things like how you confirm a story, talking to minors, being on the record, off the record, and so on. These are things that non-journalists sort of hear about, but, you know, may not be aware that there's that this is involved with a very specific kind of practice of journalism that seems to be built on this foundation of an ethical foundation, or a law foundation that becomes a matter of law. Where do these practices come from?
So these are professional journalism practices that students who go to a school like UW will learn in their news writing and reporting classes. There is an ethical code of the Society of Professional Journalists, and there's a deep and highly developed understanding of how to report ethically and what journalistic standards of truth are. So how many sources do you need to assert something as fact? How do you quote somebody saying something so that if it turns out not to be true, the fact that they said it, and that's in quote marks, that they said it is still true?
I see.
There's a lot to the practice of journalism, and journalism is like policing or teaching. It's a profession that's in the public eye. So people have a lot of opinions about journalism. And I thought, well, they ought to know how it's done if they're going to read what's supposed to be a highly realistic newsroom drama.
Yeah, I mean, I really like books about work, and they're so rare. There are so few books that really happen in a workplace. And this one, your book, describes, and I think the benefit of it is it's such a small workplace, but it's so stratified with the editor and the publisher and the assistant editor and, you know, two reporters or three reporters, and then the people in the back who actually put out the paper and mail it and so on, and these strict social stratum that happens along with the authorities that flow from, you know, the top guy down to, you know, the cub reporter, Hallie. It's an unusual look, and it's I think it's kind of timeless, really. And I think this book, it takes place in the 1989, is it?
Or thereabouts? 89.
Yeah. And I mean, it could be, you know, 2024 or, you know, 1949. It probably would have been pretty much the same thing. One of the elements of the book that I didn't mention at the outset, but I think is really a critical subplot in the book, is Hallie's relationship with a firefighter named Blue. Mm. It's not in any regular sense a love story, really. And I was interested, really, in my own response to this unusual dynamic between the two, because it's not the woman who falls for the man and the man is, you know, emotionally unavailable and reticent or whatever. It's flipped around.
So Hallie, she's really only recently graduated from college. She was, to the extent that she had a love life, it was hookup sex. And she doesn't want to stay in this town. And Blue is a source. So he's probably not someone that she should be dating at all, but they need each other.
Why couldn't you date a source?
That's one of those ethical things. If you are compromised, an objective journalist needs to be able to report bad things on people if they're true. And if you are dating or involved with someone, you're going to try to protect them, as Hallie ultimately does, and then has to confront herself about it. So you could get fired for having a relationship with a source, and reasonably so. At the same time, I know somebody who won a Pulitzer from the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, is now married to his source. It does happen. Mm-hmm. It does happen. It's hard because when you're working really hard to break a story, usually there are people, if it's an important story, there are people who have a lot to gain or have a lot at risk, and pushing that information out also puts you in a vulnerable place where people see you. And yeah, somebody who's on fire about some issue that's really important to them is gonna be attractive and is going to make those bonds. So it's a complex thing, but if my students were to ask me, you know, I teach in the journalism program at Penn State. Mm-hmm. If my students were to ask me, can I date a source? My answer would be no. No, mm-hmm. You can't. You shouldn't.
Can lawyers date their clients?
No.
And doctors can't date patients?
As they should not.
Mm-hmm. I mean, but is it a malpractice? A form of malpractice,
I don't know with regard to medical doctors. I know that in the bar association that I'm a member of, the Washington State Bar Association, yeah, you cannot date your clients. No way.
Huh, okay. There's something in the book about that you can't confirm a anonymous source. You can, if you get a tip for, that's anonymous.
Anonymous sources are very difficult because, so I'm going to go Poindexter here. I teach media law. The court, the U.S. Supreme Court has said in Cohen, which was a Minnesota case, that if you reveal an anonymous source and it harms them, they can sue you and win damages. And also, if you promise someone anonymity and you keep your promise, you can be hauled into court. A grand jury can subpoena you, and you are compelled to tell who your anonymous source is or risk jail.
As has happened.
So you're kind of between. Yeah. You're between a rock and a hard place. That was the Brandsburg case out of Kentucky that was rolled in with some stories. So it was, I think, four or five cases rolled together, but Brandsburg was the named case. And the other cases had to do with anonymous sources on Black Panther activities.
And there was a issue with Judith Miller, New York Times, on Iraq as well. Did she go to jail? She went to jail for a while on that.
She did.
Yeah. So you're sort of damned if you do and damned if you don't. If you don't, you go to jail, and if you do, then the source can sue you.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So what I tell my students is to give a conditional promise of anonymity. I won't reveal your name unless I'm subpoenaed. Uh-huh. Most of the time you don't get subpoenaed. I've never been subpoenaed to give up the name of a secret source in the 15 years I practiced journalism.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it happens.
Yeah.
Sometimes it happens.
Yeah. Let me just interrupt here and say that you're listening to Madison Bookbeat. I'm David Ahrens, the host today, and I'm talking to Cynthia Simons, who's the author of The Wrong Kind of Paper, a book about a young reporter. It's a thriller. It's kind of a funny coming of age story of a young big city reporter coming to a small and very insular town in southern Indiana, we'll call it. Okay.
Somewhere in Indiana.
Yeah. The book is available in Amazon. You wrote it 3 years ago, is that right?
Yeah, it came out second year of the pandemic. It's also available. You can order it through Lake City Books on North Hamilton Street. Of course, people can go to Amazon or any of the major online book retailers, but it's always best to support our local independents.
Mm-hmm. We had Molly Fish as a guest on this program before she opened, and it's rare for new independent bookstores to come around. So it's a great bookstore and happens to have a big selection of books by about or some relationship to Wisconsin. Do you think that Green Meadows, it's a population about 10,000, is that a typical town of that size and place, once industrial? Now it depends on an amusement park to survive.
I grew up near Cleveland, Ohio, which was a Rust Belt town. The New York Times described it as a grim post-industrial city.
Nice.
This area of the country, Wisconsin, Indiana, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, has a lot of these towns that just couldn't reinvent when big steel left, when auto manufacturing left. And it is hard to find a way to survive in a town with no jobs or very few jobs.
Mm-hmm. And the people who stay there, everyone seems quite unhappy about being there, let me say that. Mm-hmm. You know, even one of the reporters who's a really noxious booster, he's about the only one, and he's, you know, sort of drank the Kool-Aid from the Chamber of Commerce. But everyone who, you say that, you know, no one goes to college or few people go to college. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you think about the predicament of the other characters in the book who are all in desperate straits of one kind or another, they're all too poor to leave, really. I mean, they're stuck, and you start thinking about, well, why don't you leave? And you realize that, just like in a way, Hallie, I mean, she sort of has the benefit of her degree, her class status, and just her youth to be able to go back to Minneapolis or whatever and sleep on her friend's couch. But for the other characters who have young children or whatever, they just don't have the money to mm-hmm. set up anywhere. Mm-hmm. And they have to endure the town and the work life that's kind of degrading. It's a pretty grim situation. And so what do you think the Trump vote was in Green Meadow?
If there was one, I imagine, I mean, it is a fictional town, but I imagine it would have gone for Trump.
Oh, I think in a really big way. Yeah.
There is this unheard group of people who don't have options, and Trump has made them feel recognized, even if he did not deliver the jobs that they needed. Don't get me started on Trump.
I just meant it as a,
can't be positive and upbeat.
I think it's you know, pretty well documented that that is our big voting base for him is rural voters, especially rural poor voters are a base for him. And this town as well, which is, you know, described as really all white town as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a bit about another downer of a story other than Trump is the future of print journalism. Don't groan yet. I mean, every year, or maybe every week, I'm not sure, I seem to read another obit about the end of newspapers as we know it. I mean, you probably know what the stats are, but they're pretty grim in terms of how quickly newspapers are folding, shrinking. So in the absence of these local newspapers and the absence of even these community newspapers, we have community newspapers surrounding Madison, in the community surrounding Madison, and they're pretty much like the Daily Observer. You know, a lot of school sports and Rotary Club and, you know, New Park open, whatever. I mean, there's not going to be any kind of expose of it. So what happens in that absence?
Well, corruption can blossom unseen. Police corruption is the one that we focus on because, of course, they can kill people. But regular old government official corruption, schools where kids don't learn and aren't taught in a way that's respectful of them, you name it, if nobody's watching, really bad things can happen. And nobody's watching in a lot of places. One of my colleagues has a, so what we're finding is that in places where there is no daily journalism with professional reporters covering beats like City Hall and courts and cops, the people are depending on social media and news from websites that may or may not even be true. So he's got a program.
Is Next Door the future of local journalism?
It is a future, and Next Door is better than some other sites. We have rapidly deprofessionalized journalism because we're too immature to pay for the information that democracy needs. Now, there are some nonprofit organizations that are doing amazingly good journalism, and there are some foundations that are putting money into the remaining professional journalism at the small town level. But it's bleak. It's really bleak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Next Door and, you know, Facebook seems to occupy the vacuum that journalism, especially local journalism, and even the, you know, I people were jumping up and down and think it's great that the New York Times circulation is, you know, just millions on, you know, millions of people subscribe to their website, and probably a tenth of that to the actual newspaper. But it's really become the national paper, and the Wall Street Journal is sort of the other national paper for other folks. But I thought that there's two edges to that issue, two edges to that sword, and the other one is that big city newspapers from cities outside of New York, you know, people don't feel like, I need to read the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel anymore because I subscribe to the New York Times. Mm-hmm. Or that those newspapers as well really get a beating from that. Mm-hmm. So it's not just the small town papers, but I mean, we're seeing really the big city papers as well. I mean, you want to talk a bit about sort of the specter of the Aldine hedge fund and, you know, what...
Well, hedge funds are taking local advertising dollars out of the community, and their first duty is to their shareholders. You know, in a place like Storm Lake, there's often some local person, often an older person, who has a deep commitment to the town and keeps publishing. Sometimes they make payroll out of their personal savings. A hedge fund doesn't ever do anything of that nature. And it isn't, it's like hospitals. There's some things that hedge funds shouldn't run. And we as media consumers should choose those independents, should donate to community radio, should donate to public radio and public television. But we need to look at media systems and particularly how they're funded, because if we just rely on market forces, we're going to get what we've been getting, which is less and less and less.
Yeah, I mean, the this Aldine hedge fund, which is described in all reports as highly secretive, that is who it is, and the hedge fund is rather unknown, but they just bought the Chicago Tribune, and it's now the second largest newspaper chain in the country. And they, you know, they're known for coming in and really decimating the newsrooms and I guess relying on wire service press releases and just sort of junk coverage. But the
wire services are largely, the wire service coverage largely comes from members. So the Associated Press is an association of member newspapers. They do have reporters in bureaus. I worked for both the AP and UPI. But most of their content comes mm-hmm. from daily newspapers. So if those daily newspaper members have mm-hmm. empty newsrooms, there's going to be less on the wire.
Yeah. What is it, you know, I'm thinking about what the economics of this are, why would a hedge fund buy a newspaper? We think of newspapers as being an industry in decline. And is it because, and my thought was about the Chicago Tribune, mm-hmm. is that they have great real estate. I mean, they have that fantastic...
They have great real estate, sure.
They have a great building. I mean, that's worth, God, you know, gobs of money right downtown. And their press, which is in town as well, that just that alone would be of value to them. And they really don't care about what happens in the building. They just want the building. And this is probably true for a lot of the big city newspapers that they take over. Is that the primary thing that they're looking for is real estate?
I don't know if that's true. I haven't looked at that particular aspect of it enough to give an intelligent response. Part of newspaper chains is eliminating competition. So they may be buying up newspapers so that there will be no competition for their other newspapers, or so they can sell them to the competitors who will then shutter them. It's about making money.
Yeah.
It's not about delivering news to people who need it in order to function in a democracy.
Yeah, I don't think that's something that comes up at their meetings is how do we, you know, the role of news and information and citizenship isn't an item, but just trying to figure out what the economics, how this plays out, given you know losses and losses and losses, ever higher losses of readership and ad dollars and whatever. I mean, when the classifieds ads went out of many of the newspapers due to the first big website, I can't even remember the name of it now, that had ads for cars and whatever.
Craigslist,
right. That Craigslist decimated. I mean, that was the first big body blow was Craigslist. Yes. And Craig said, well, I guess... there's got to be roadkill on towards technological progress, and the roadkill happens to be all the newspapers in the country as they lost their classified ads. So again, this is David Ahrens, and I'm talking to Cynthia Simons who's now a faculty.
David, it's Simmons,
sorry. Simmons, okay.
And since you got to redo the reintro, I just heard from Iris, Wrong Kind of Paper can be ordered through the Room of Her Own website as well.
Okay.
So can I give them a plug?
Do. Okay, Room of One's Own. Yeah, I was sorry to see that it's not in the library system, and it should be. How come it's Wrong Kind of Paper and not the Wrong Kind of Paper?
I don't know. I had a working title for it for many years. The working title was Pink. And a friend of mine who runs the Center County Film Fest here in Pennsylvania. She's just like, that's all wrong. And I'm like, what? And she's like, your book title should be a log line. What's the book about? And I said, you know, we worked on it back and forth. And she said, it's about somebody who goes to work at the wrong kind of paper. And I'm like, yeah, it's the wrong kind of paper.
Uh-huh.
And she's like, that's your title. Wrong kind of paper.
Just wrong kind of paper.
Wrong kind of paper.
Yeah. Okay. I get it.
And it's also a pun. I'm not giving away the end, but it is a pun on how the plot conflict is ultimately resolved.
So when you came, just let's get back to the beginning here. When you came to the station after, I assume, a long absence, what struck you about it as the same, different, or whatever?
There's a certain beauty in WORT as a community organization that people who live other places don't have. And that is that community media lets everybody in the door and lets regular people talk about what's important to them. And also in the news department gives regular people the opportunity to confront authority. And if I were starting out in journalism, I would be volunteering at the news department every day. So I was struck by what an important institution it is. Some of the people who were volunteers when I was there have gone on to really great success. Chip Mitchell is at WBEZ. He had a podcast on police brutality. Tom Waters, who unfortunately was one of the early COVID victims, he took his activism to Queens, New York, and was known in the legislature when he came in to talk about low-income housing issues. He had the statistical abilities of, you know, a top UW-Madison grad student able to break out how spending on affordable housing would make a difference in people's lives and be circulated back into the economy. There were some really, really wonderful people there at that time who used the sandbox that we were sometimes accused of being to develop skills that then they took out into the world. And then, of course, it was really nice to see old friends, like Esty. It was really nice to see people I recognized. I mean, it was literally 30 years.
Oh, really?
That's a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I left in, let's see, what was it, 30 years? I left in 95.
Yeah. Pretty
so it's
damn
been a
close.
Long time.
Yeah. And where did you go from here?
I went to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Oh, mm-hmm. I covered the legislature for KUNM, a terrific public station that's a lot more like a community station than most publics. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I went to Seattle, wound up going to law school in Seattle, and then started teaching media law, first at the University of Washington and now at Penn State.
Did you have a practice as an attorney, or you just went right into academia?
No, I don't think I have the personality to practice law. Who knows? I may sometime need to fall back on my law. But no, I've always taught media law.
And what advice do you give journalism students who are idealistic and, of course, hopeful about, you know, a career as Hallie does? I mean, she expected to go to the New York Times more or less directly from journalism school.
Well, my advice is don't buy anything on credit. You need to continue to live like a student because the pay is going to be bad and the jobs are unpredictable. You can get laid off at any time. And just ride it while it's fun. It is the funnest job you can have. I tell people it's the most fun you can have without breaking the law. And it is really, really special in life to tell other people's stories. People let you into their homes. They mm-hmm. tell you about their dead children.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. about, you know, what's going on in their workplaces. They share and they trust you to tell their story to make life better mm-hmm. in their community. And that's a really special way to make a living. It's very interesting. You're never bored.
Yeah.
And so I would still go into journalism, and I'm glad that my students still want to go into journalism, but it's not something you do for money.
Yeah.
A few people get rich. Very few. Very few.
Right. Right. It's people aren't going to be the, you know, host of, you know, what's the guy, Lester Holtz or whatever, you know. There are few stars in it. Right. And most people are very, not minimum wage, but it's, I assume, fairly low pay in many places that the union for journalists.
It's incredibly low.
Yeah.
Incredibly low. Our students, we often counsel them to get a job waiting tables or let your parents know if they can afford to, that you're going to need them to continue to support you for a year or two in that first job
mm-hmm.
because the pay is so low.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your time here today. And,
sure.
And thanks for the book. I really enjoyed it. And I, you know, kept thinking about how, what a cool movie this could be too, because it has that thriller. No, it has a love interest to it. It has a thriller yeah. part to it. Some low-level violence, all these subplots that are going on that are real people. So for those people who are looking for a story for a screenplay, this has, I think that it has potential. So,
well, thank you.
Yeah. So thank you for talking to us on Madison BookBeat. And that's where you've been listening on Madison BookBeat, WORT's program on Wisconsin authors and books about Wisconsin. And we've been talking to Cynthia Simmons, S-I-M-M-O-N-S. You could get it at Room of One's Own or at Lake City Books. Or if you must, you could get it at Amazon. Thanks very much for your time, and hope to read another book by you at some point.
Thank you.
You think so?
Don't know.
Okay.
Maybe just a play.
Okay. All right, I'll be looking for that.
As the EQ guy, and I want you all to tune in on Monday night, March 11th at 7 p.m. for my newest edition of my DJ Les Luster's Rock Show on the WORT FM Access Hour. Started following earthquakes the day of the Northridge earthquake in the Los Angeles area of Southern California on January 17, 1994, and now in a big 30 years of following all seismic activity all around the world. world, as many of you know. And now, featuring my top 10 list of all my favorite songs. Tune in and hear all your old-timey favorite songs right here on the WORTFM Access Hour when DJ Les Luster's Rock Show returns one more time on the Access Hour. That's Monday, March 11th at 7 p.m., everybody.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and ResTech Services, serving area businesses, nonprofits, and multi-dwelling properties with high-speed, net-neutral internet, digital phone, and television services. On the web at restechservices.net or by phone at 608-663-3868.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Monday, March 11th.
MedMen here for Action Weirdos Productions. This week in music history for March 11th. A little music quiz for you today. Here's a bunch of songs. Try to guess what they have in common.
Hey, a little less conversation, a little more action.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Songs, along with thousands of others, including 150 top 10 U.S. hits and 40 number one singles, have Harold Simon Belsky in common. Better known as Hal Blaine, he was a session drummer and the most recorded studio drummer in music history. He coined the name and was a member of the Wrecking Crew, a collective of U.S. session musicians responsible for many studio recordings in the 1960s and 70s. Older musicians felt that the group's embrace of rock and roll was going to wreck the music industry. Bruce Gary, drummer for The Knack, said he was surprised and a little disappointed to find that his top 10 favorite drummers all turned out to be Hal Blaine. Hal played on 6 consecutive Grammy-winning albums of the year between 1966 and 1971, and is credited with popularizing the disco beat. In addition to being a tremendously prolific session drummer, Hal Blaine released 5 percussion